Глава научного совета Центра политической конъюнктуры Александр Чесноков
постепенно начал внимание на лицемерие американцев. По его мнению,
программой Алексей Леонидович Кудрин.
Это попытка для Прохорова, мягко говоря, не первая. Сегодня он вновь с нуля.
Playing the angles and they're hedging their bets. They're roaming the political landscape, looking for safe passage. An interesting new species has appeared in Russia's political landscape since mass opposition to the system broke out a year and a half ago. The political entrepreneur. These long-time insiders have been calculating and scrambling to secure a safe landing, regardless of how the current political crisis is resolved. Some are doing so out of cynicism. This is politics, after all. Some are acting on principle. Most out of some combination of the two. But from minor bureaucrats to regime heavyweights, a lot of people are doing it. We've had Alexei Chesnokov resigning from his leadership post in United Russia, and Sergei Mironov flipping and flopping between the regime and the opposition and back again. We've had Mikhail Prokhorov and Alexei Kudrin flirting with both the Kremlin and the Russian street. Simultaneously calculating and preparing for life with and without Vladimir Putin is a tricky game. Putin is very much still in charge and is tightening his grip. Open disloyalty is dangerous. But with the tectonic plates of Russian politics rumbling and no sign of the turbulence abating, there's also no sign of what the landscape will look like when the dust finally settles. Meet Russia's political entrepreneurs, whose gambles will pay off and who will be left out in the cold. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert at Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online portal Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Mark, if I remember correctly, you were the one who coined the term political entrepreneur. It was about a year and a half ago, way back on one of our early podcasts. And I just wanted to ask you to expound on that a little bit. What are the elements of a successful strategy of political entrepreneurship in this kind of period of uncertainty? And who do you think is playing the game well right now?
Well, thanks. Yes, I was trying to break down the concept a little and think about what kinds of political entrepreneur there are, because clearly not everyone is the same. And broadly speaking, I think there's three kinds based on three types of resource that they bring into the game, and each of which therefore has a slightly different strategy. First of all, there's those whose resources are innate. They're innate to themselves. You can't take them away, or at least not easily. And that tends to mean, for example, their reputation. Or maybe it's friendships and personal links. So we're talking about people like, say, Shoigu, defense minister who has a very good reputation as being a sort of a non-political technocrat, gets the job done. We're seeing Moscow Mayor Sobyanin, who's likewise presenting himself that with an extra little side order of nationalism these days, as he talks about migrants in Moscow being a problem. Kudrin, likewise, he may not be popular in the Russian street, but nonetheless, his reputation internationally is such that he's a very useful person to bring to the table. And Kudrin is interesting because he also has the friendship angle, a friendship with Putin. Rogozin is another one whose reputation is powerful. And even in his own little way, Medvedev, who at least has a certain function that is Medvedev's. So that's person number one. And their main strategy really is to build their identity, build their networks. Again, these are not people who, at the moment at least, can openly challenge Putin. That is, as you said, terribly dangerous. So instead, they really have to try and make themselves indispensable for both the Putin era and the post-Putin era. So I think they're very much aimed at sort of, Shoigu is making himself into a super Shoigu. You know, he wants to just simply increase those elements of his reputation that make him powerful. Then there's the second type of political entrepreneur whose resources are political but losable. And that tends to mean money. Mm. You know, money that is notionally yours, but you're just one tax investigation, one visit from the investigations committee, one raiding or whatever, away from actually being a pauper if you're lucky, in prison if you're unlucky. And, I mean, I think here Prokhorov fits. Yeah. You know, he has phenomenal financial resources, but he knows full well that there are limits to actually how useful those are.
Although he's been careful to keep some of those assets abroad.
Exactly. So on the one hand, essentially what he's looking at is what these people are looking at, and I'd also include Sechin in this category nowadays. And their key thing is to protect what they've got. They have powerful resources, resources that will also be useful in a post-Putin era. The key thing is they have to make sure they don't lose them. And obviously, if they can expand them, that's nice. But I think it's essentially quite a defensive strategy. And you can see that, with, for example, with the way Prokhorov works, in that on the one hand, he tries to every now and then present himself as having some wider political agenda. But as soon as there's the slightest hint that that might become politically dangerous, he retrenches. So again, I think defensiveness always...
So they're innately conservative, actually, in the
Absolutely.
Strategy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's the third person whose resources are positional. They're because of where they are now, and on the whole, that means within the government structure. And therefore, they can just as easily lose it tomorrow. And, I mean, in a way, we got two interestingly sort of varied, obvious examples. Someone like Bastrykin, but also Chesniakov. And for them, really, their options are two. If you're in positions like that, you want to deepen your power base. And we see that with Bastrykin. We see that with all the various security service operators. They're trying to build their empires, knowing full well that ultimately they could all be sacked. But what they're trying to do is make it so that if they are sacked, the cost of doing so
is high.
But then again, one of the ways that positional people have power is through patrons. And the Chesniakov example is an example of someone whose patron suddenly gets taken away when Surkov goes. And then so what does he do? I mean, and I think the answer is you diversify. You look for alternatives, whether it's an alternative patron within the system or an alternative role without the system. And I think that's what we're seeing with
that. What if you're a Bastrykin and your patron is Putin himself, and only Putin himself? How does a Bastrykin play the political entrepreneur game, because his eggs are all in one basket? I might even put Sechin in that category as well. If you're so tightly tied to the current regime that you don't even seem to have other options, how do you play this game?
To be honest, you have to just simply try and keep the regime running as long as possible. Again, if we want to play the historical game, I mean, in some ways, look at what happened to Beria. In that he tried
That's
to build
exactly
himself
a
post-Stalin role, you know, bizarrely liberal in some of his sort of pronouncements, while essentially trying to prepare for a coup. And, you know, he was destroyed because the rest of the elite thought, there's no way we're allowing him. I mean, in some ways, and again, you know, we always have to be cautious. You know, I will be channeling historian Sean here and say that definitely this is not Stalinism.
Right, right. But the Bastrykin Beria thing does, the parallel is impossible to ignore.
But this is what, I mean, in the last podcast you talked about the Siloviki going for broke. And in some ways I think this is what makes them, particularly someone like Bastrykin, so dangerous. It's precisely he cannot meaningfully create for himself a post-Putin role.
Right.
Sometimes some people are clever enough and sophisticated enough that they can actually manage that. We saw that, for example, with a lot of the figures within the KGB at the end of the Soviet era, who were also maintaining their links with Yeltsin. Bastrykin certainly has built himself a position where there's no way he can do anything else. So his only strategy is to make sure, A, he keeps Putin's support, but B, Putin stays in power as long as possible.
Right. What about Sechin? Would you put him in the same category?
I feel that Sechin has now moved beyond just simply being a functionary. I think really we should think of him as an oligarch. The same way as I don't really see him anymore as a figure of the Siloviki.
But without Rosneft, what is he?
Well, okay, he's nothing without Rosneft. But I mean, but he doesn't control Rosneft just simply because Putin says so today. I mean, he's
got his own network,
a formidable array. Right. I mean, again, it would not be an easy thing to remove him from Rosneft without having to fight a lot of political battles along the way.
Kirill, what do you think? Who's playing the game well and who's not right now?
Well, first of all, I'd like to draw your attention to the nature of this particular kind of business. If we are speaking about entrepreneurs and so on, so we are speaking about, you know, some sort of business. And this political business, like, you know, any other sort of business, has its own, you know, small figures, little small business, like, you know, corner shops, convenience shops, and so on, and mega stores. And I love this definition coined by Mark, political entrepreneurs, but we must sort them out to make a sort of, you know, classification of them. For me, it's like, you know, a football game, soccer game, because some of these political entrepreneurs, they look like, you know, just players. You mentioned Chesnokov. He is, you know, a second-rate midfield player in this game. And when we're speaking about, you know, Sechin, Prokhorov, and so on, they're like, you know, managers of huge football clubs. And that is the difference. That is the very interesting difference, because you can be a political entrepreneur with, you know, your own very, very limited resources, and you're trying to balance between, you know, a very strong powers. It's like, you know, Zhirinovsky is playing this game for more than for 20 years. And such figures like, you know, Sergei Mironov, for me, it's a second edition of Zhirinovsky, Putin version of Zhirinovsky. The same is about this guy, Chesnokov, and so on. What about serious players like Sechin, Bastrykin, and so on? We can divide them into two teams, if you want. First of them, which are, you know, relatively independent figures like Prokhorov and Sechin, because they have their own resources, which are different from the, you know, resources of Putin's regime itself and Putin himself. Of course, they connected to the regime, of course. But we can imagine the situation when, you know, this regime will, you know, end up somehow, and they will survive this failure. I am absolutely sure, and Prokhorov and Sechin will survive. And I totally agree with Mark that Bastrykin is the figure of, you know, the other, from the other, you know, sort of these political entrepreneurs. Of course, he wouldn't and couldn't survive at the end of this regime. He has not his only resources. His resource is just Putin. But what is common for all of them, including, by the way, Mikhail Prokhorov, that they don't want the end of the recent political situation. They don't want Putin's regime to end up somehow. They want to prolong somehow the...
All of them?
I am absolutely sure that all of them, of course, I know that you can't agree with me, but I'm absolutely sure that even Mikhail Prokhorov wants to go on this way, but slightly in, you know, other mode, to modernize this regime, but not to, you know, kill it, or, you know, he don't want this regime to finish somehow. That's my opinion.
Mark, would you agree with that? I'm not sure they all want to prolong the regime. I think some of them are hedging. Like Kudrin would prefer either liberalizing this regime or maybe replacing it with something more liberal.
I think all of these are people who currently do well out of the status quo. Some do better, some do not quite as well, but frankly, they're all doing absolutely fine. So I agree with Kirill that actually they would all quite like the status quo to continue. My view, though, is that for most of them, they don't believe it will.
Right.
So in some ways, I think it's, well, you know, everyone's plan B we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Plan A is that, you know, everything would have worked out fine and the Russian people and the Russian economy would have cooperated and things would have gone well. But given that that's not happened, and this is where you begin to get the divergences. This is where you get, you know, because everyone might share plan A, but everyone has their own plan B.
Right. Right.
So I mean, I'd agree with Kirill, but in some ways, I think just for most of them, that's just a pipe dream. It's that the days that could is likely have gone.
Right, and the ones like Bastrykin that can't have a plan B are going to fight like the devil to keep plan A in place, where a Kudrin, a Prokhorov, a Sechin could have a plan B.
Absolutely. And again, thinking of someone like Bastrykin, for the moment, he relies on Putin. But certainly if, let's say, you know, things continue, they stabilize, Putin gets and comes back for a second term, and it becomes clear that there is going to be a succession and a managed succession at that, then in a way he's in a position to also try and make himself invaluable to whoever's going to be Putin's successor. So, I mean, I think even him, it's not as if he knows that he has a clock that's ticking away and then he's out of office. So, again, I think, you know, everyone has some sense of what could follow. Just for some people, and again, exactly, the Prokhorovs and the Kudrins of this world have far greater options than the Bastrykins.
Right. Now, there's a wonderful phrase in the Russian language, political prostitution. It's bantered about a lot in the press and on the television. Where is the line between political entrepreneurship and political prostitution? Or is there a line?
I would find it hard to see that there being a line except in terms of I'm a political entrepreneur, you are a political prostitute.
So it's in the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely.
I mean, is it, I mean, because the way I was thinking about it is it's the degree to which your entrepreneurship, if you will, is driven by principles and the degree to which it's driven by naked cynicism and ambition. It strikes me that Kudrin sincerely believes that the system has to change, that the system has to open up and liberalize and pluralize and so on. Where I would not say the same for a Sechin, although he would adapt to a new system and survive in a new system. So I guess maybe that's the line. Kirill, what do you think? You've probably come across this term as much as I have in the Russian media. Where's the line?
I think if we can use, you know, some sort of metaphor, there is a difference between those who are running the brothel and who is working there. And political entrepreneurs, they're running political brothel, and political prostitutes, they work for in this brothel. That is the difference. And who is, you know, in Marxist terms, who is the owner of the, you know,
means of production?
Yes.
So we've gone from brothels to Karl Marx. I like it.
Yes, and in this you know division or this classification, of course, Rogozin, Mironov, who else? Chesnokov, in some sense, of course, they're political prostitutes. Sorry, but they are. Just in the limits, inside the limits of this system, yes, this imagined, imaginable system. And who are running the political brothel, all of us, we know, of course, all of them, and so that is the difference. The aim of, the question is the aim of this way of this, you know, way of life or, you know, activity, what are the aims of being political entrepreneur? If you want just to survive or to earn, you know, just to earn money or to do something
like this.
Well,
to land
this
on solid ground when the system changes. And I want to get into the historical aspect of this a little bit, because this is not the first time we've seen a paradigm shift. It's not shifted yet, but it seems to be shifting. But that's the aim. It's a survival at the bare minimum. But to have a nice position in the new system is the ultimate aim. Without risking
sense,
your position in the old system, because it might not change.
In this sense, there is a difference between, you know, modern Russian Talleyrands, who are trying to survive any change of any system in Russia. And the other way is, you know, Russian, you know, Napoleons or whoever, or Decembrists, who are trying to reach their own political aims. The question is, if all these people or anyone from them just really, really, actually has their own political aims, and that is the, I think it's a crucial question. We just, you know, mentioned plan A and plan B. Plan A, if, you know, the regime will go on in some way, and plan B, if the regime will change or, you know, will, you know, end up somehow and so on. But don't forget, or the question is, if they or anyone from them has, you know, so-called plan B prim to change the regime with their own efforts.
Somebody on the inside? I don't see anything like that, Mark. Do you?
No, I think that this is a system which has essentially squeezed and ground out any real idealism or any real programmatic division. And Kudrin is one possible sort of exception because he's had the indulgence of Putin's friendship. Mm-hmm. But even he, this is not some kind of free market Solzhenitsyn, willing to go to the gulag for his vision. We can see that obviously a Kremlin with Shoigu behind the big desk would be very different from, God forbid, a Kremlin with Ivanov behind it. But those don't, I think, represent visions for Russia. So much as just these different people with different styles and different ideas about the future. This is nothing sort of grand and so forth. So, I mean, I do feel that none of these people are, in essence, that different.
There's
from
no
each
revolutionaries
other.
In this crowd.
No, I mean, even, you know, there is no Gorbachev. Whether right. that's a good thing or a bad is entirely up to you. There is just simply the fact that whoever does replace will necessarily bring changes in personnel, in policy, in emphasis, in style, which all will actually have an impact. But I don't believe that's why they're doing it. They're doing it because, hey, there's one big desk and you want to be the one sitting behind it. Or at the very least, you want to survive when there's a change of whoever's mm-hmm. sitting behind it.
Mm-hmm. Kirill, you mentioned Mironov, and he is somebody that I did want to raise. I find the comparison with Zhirinovsky interesting. He has been flipping and flopping like I've never seen before since December 2011. He seemed to, for a time there, be going almost whole hog with the opposition. Now he's back to the old Mironov of circa 2007, of being as loyal to Putin as one can imagine. What explains this? Did the costs of opposition, Mark, let's start with you. Was it the costs of going into opposition became just far too apparent to him? How do you interpret Mironov's behavior? Because it is the more bizarre of the entrepreneurs, I would say. The others, I can kind of make sense of what they're doing, but Mironov, I've had trouble putting logic around it.
Well, Brian, let me thank you so much for starting me with that particular question. I honestly have no idea. My speculation is precisely going what you were saying about the costs, or rather the cost-benefit analysis, that he thought that he was surfing a wave, and suddenly he realized that it wasn't going to take him where he wanted to get, that he wasn't sort of going to become the kind of leadership figure that I think he imagined, and that precisely it wasn't going to become an effortless transition to a new kind of Russia. And at that point, he panicked. And realizing precisely that his resources were actually relatively limited, the only thing he could do, I mean, you know, he couldn't. See, Prokhorov can, for example, sometimes seem to overstep the line. But then just as long as he just quietly steps back, he's fine. Because he has massive resources of his own.
Where Mironov only had position.
Precisely. So I think, you know, he actually had to, you know, if we're talking about the sort of, you know, political prostitution compared to entrepreneurship. I mean, you know, he really did have to strip down and right. make himself as gaudy and appealing as possible.
To Putin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he lost his speakership. He almost lost his party chairmanship of A Just Russia. Kirill, what do you think of Mironov's activities? I know you think he's the new Zhirinovsky.
I'd like to propose another one classification. Classification is the division between real players and functions. Zhirinovsky, Chesnokov, or Mironov, they are not players, they are functions. It's like in, National Hockey League in 1970s.
What is it with the sports analogies from you?
Yes, 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 yes. I remember this ice hockey team, Philadelphia Flyers,
yeah.
I think. Mm-hmm. And there was...
You're going to talk about Dave Schultz, aren't you?
Yeah, some guy, Bobby Clark.
Bobby Clark.
Yes, he was not a player, he was a function. Yes, he just to knock down the most talented
You're thinking of Dave Schultz, actually. Bobby Clark was a goal scorer. I remember...
No.
Yes,
he was absolutely toothless. I remember.
Yeah, he was toothless, yes. But he was a player. But you're thinking of Dave Schultz, the guy that would start a fight with the best player on the other team all the time.
I surrender.
Yeah, you're thinking of Dave Schultz. I was a hockey fan in the 70s.
I remember they played, you know, with the Soviet team in 1975. That was not a... Okay, it was not Bobby Clark, it was another guy, but he was not a player, he was a function, yes? Just to knock down the enemy and then to leave
he would start a fight with the best player on the other team. Yes, they get in a fight, they both get kicked out of the game, and that would take their best player off the ice. Yeah, no, it was... They won the Stanley Cup twice in a row playing that way.
And that is just a function, yes. And Zhirinovsky has his own function. Mironov has his own function. Chistakov had his own function, not now. And political players, they have a set of functions. Anyway, if we cannot speak about them as human beings and all this richness of human character and so on, but anyway, they have a set of functions. But Zhirinovsky and Mironov and Rogozin, by the way, it's the only one function. It's not a political player.
So to be a prop in the system, essentially. Yes. I mean, Zhirinovsky played the role of a lightning rod. What was Mironov's function in the system?
He was trying to change it. He was, you know, his only function was the head of so-called opposition party, yes,
right.
Opposition party. When he forgot that he is just a function and not a political player, he was punished.
Mm-hmm.
And now he just returned to his initial role.
Function.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's all. That's my only explanation of the situation with Mironov.
Now,
let me just pick up on a point you make about Rogozin there as being a function. I think certainly no sporting analogies here. Let's have Pinocchio instead. I mean, Rogozin is the wooden puppet who became a boy in that he had a function. And he played that very well. But I think he's now moved to the point where he has acquired personal weight, personal roles, and, above all, he's acquired a personal support base by meticulously placing clients of his within the military-industrial complex and elsewhere. So, I mean, I agree with you entirely, but I think, we have to be aware that this is sometimes a permeable barrier.
And I guess if you want to push that analogy, Mironov was a puppet who wanted to become a boy but never quite made it there. Zhirinovsky understands he's a puppet and will play that role forever, I guess.
Happily dances on the strings.
Now, all of this bobbing and weaving and hedging and it creates a bit of instability, doesn't it? I mean, this is dangerous to the system, is it not, Mark?
Definitely. I think it's one of these things that it becomes a vicious circle. Precisely because of instability in the system, a sense of drift, a sense that actually, I mean, you know, if for example, the castling had gone smoothly, if they hadn't been a protest movement, or if it had been very quickly dealt with, either violently or much more effectively by co-opting it, I don't think we would have seen any of this. People would have realized, no, Putin is still the man, he's still in charge, we just operate within the system. There would be the inevitable clan wars from time to time, there would be factional rivalries, the sorts of things that we saw in earlier iterations of Putin. It's precisely because of that sense of, hang on a minute, what we are expecting in the Kremlin is not there. There is something of a vacuum. That has got people thinking. And the more people think, then actually the more that undermines the power of Putin, the power of Putin to be the great decider, and hence greater instability, which in turn further undermines Putin, and so it goes. So now, it doesn't mean to say that it's necessarily an inevitable process. Something could, either Putin could turn around and actually manage to suddenly demonstrate mastery of the situation, or maybe some external sort of threat to the system as a whole. You know, let's say if there was some massive new Bolotnaya that looked as if it was going to be much more dangerous, then that's the point where you actually get Ivanov, Shoigu and Prokhorov all having a good reason to actually cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
But barring such, I think, quite unlikely deus ex machina, I think we will see a continuing spiral of instability.
So this is going to be kind of a slow death if this continues.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we do have the benefit of hindsight on some of this. And before we move on, I wanted to touch on it because this isn't the first time the paradigm has appeared to be shifting. The last time I would say was 1998 to 2000, kind of the death throes of the Yeltsin system. And the time before that was, you know, 89 to 91, the death throes of the Soviet system. And I wanted to kind of just briefly look at the political entrepreneurship in those periods and see if we can glean any lessons. What's the main lesson from 98 to 2000? I mean, what happened at that point? You began to see defections where? Well, it was Lushkov and Primakov after the financial crisis. So you had a financial shock to the system. You had the elite split, essentially, in a very, very open way. And you saw a lot of the elite, particularly the regional elite, go with this fatherland all-Russia formulation that coalesced around Yevgeny Primakov and Yuri Lushkov. At the time, Primakov, of course, served briefly as prime minister before being sacked in the parade of sackings that happened towards the end of the Yeltsin period. Lushkov, of course, the former mayor of Moscow. They had got the regional leaders all together, and it really looked at the time like they looked like people that were confident and were ready to take over, and it looked like it was going to happen before the rise of Putin. What does that period teach us about today?
Well, I would say that it teaches us, first of all, the danger of being the front runner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things, it was precisely because it looked so clear that the Primakov-Lushkov machine was going to roll all the way into the Kremlin, that everyone who wasn't in that particular machine had a very, very good reason to actually say, no, we need something else. And this is why you had this very unusual, the slick and consensual rise of Putin,
mm-hmm.
who was very, I mean, he played his political career very, very well. We have to acknowledge that. And he managed to present himself as being the right person for a whole variety of different roles, functions, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of, he seemed to be the strong nationalist. He could play the Silovik card just as effectively as Primakov could.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to be the protector for the existing elite's interests, obviously, especially the family around mm-hmm. Yeltsin. But generally speaking, he was clearly a tough figure, but nonetheless, he hadn't already accumulated a massive baggage of clients who he had to place in key jobs or whatever. But the key thing is, I mean, one of his great strengths was precisely he was not either Lushkov or Primakov or their creature.
But an interesting thing happened there, and that is that, remember, Putin was the candidate of the family, of the Yeltsin family, to head off this juggernaut of the Primakov-Lushkov machine. Right. But then what did Putin do once he got into the big chair? Well, he basically neutered the family and brought the Lushkov-Primakov machine into his own system. So it's almost like the best laid. Yeah, Putin was the thing to stop that machine, but he ended up running it.
This is how it always worked. I mean, he allowed everyone to assume certain things about himself. And in fact, again, give him his due, he very rarely seems to have had to, as it were, lie.
Right.
He just simply, by not demurring, allowed people to think that lots of different people, from Berezovsky onwards, thought of him as their man.
Mm-hmm.
All along, Putin was Putin's man.
Right.
And again, those are the glory days of Putin. He realized that actually, rather than trying to destroy the opposition,
the systemic opposition.
Within
exactly
a limited sort of sense, far, far better to bring them in. And so that's what he did. Yeltsin and co. were frankly no longer useful, and therefore why bother protecting them? He was, in that respect, he was a very disloyal client. But on the other hand, people like Lushkov were still very, very useful indeed. And therefore the last thing he wanted, in this, I mean, he followed Machiavelli, who said that when you take over a city, either you make the local principality your friends, or you destroy them utterly.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real middle way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he realized that actually the best thing to do was to make them his friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kirill, what about the shift from the late Soviet period when the system shifted again? You saw political entrepreneurship at that time as well. What lessons do we learn from that period?
I think if you would like to, you know, complete this sport metaphor, in the beginning, in the beginning, in 1990s, maybe even in the beginning of 2000s, that was sort of cricket. Sometimes, of course, they played not with balls but human heads, but that was not very often. Then the play. Then the rules of the play changed, and it turned out that it's sort of ice hockey, more brutal, more dangerous and more dynamic. And now it looks like not a sport; it's a fight of two or three street gangs.
I'm not sure if you've been watching ESPN or Game of Thrones, but
no. So it's a way from relative complexity to utter simplicity.
Mark, I think one of the lessons we can learn from the transition from the Soviet to the post-Soviet and the political entrepreneurship that was going on at the time is how the Siloviki fared. No, I mean they did quite well and managed to smoothly segue into the new system, and what lessons can we learn from that, do you think?
Well, I think two lessons. One is that precisely everyone ultimately needs spies, and I use spies in the sort of broadest sense of the word. Just as, quite frankly, many of the Tsarist Akhrana ended up within the Bolshevik security apparatus, so too it shouldn't be any great surprise that we found people who managed to sort of reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. But again, what happened was that you actually had a collapse in the functional unity of the KGB. Mm-hmm. You quite literally had people in adjoining offices within the Lubyanka spying on each other and reporting. One group was basically telling Korshakov and thus Yeltsin what was going on. Another group were actually still talking to Khrushchev and therefore the sort of the more hardline conservative variant. So, but basically, what happened is actually the KGB suffered its own outbreak of political entrepreneurship. Which shattered its unity. But I think I just want to throw in one other point, is that one of the reasons why the KGB sort of was infected with this kind of division was precisely because it just simply reflected the wider division within the elite. When Gorbachev brought in democratization, essentially it forced every regional party boss to become a political entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden you suddenly had to deal with a sort of a reality in which however much you could rig the system, nonetheless elections were going to come along and there would be certain expectations. And therefore you suddenly needed to be able to win in a new game. And one of the ways that they responded was precisely basically cutting deals with their local KGB apparatuses. Say, okay, well, how can we win elections? Whom do we need to nobble? Whom do we need to get out of the way who are going to be dangerous to us? How can we pack the vote? Essentially, the KGB became the political technologists on a local level. And that happened on a local level, and then obviously people in Moscow became infected by the same process.
And as everything splintered, you had different KGBs operating throughout the entire country. And then when the new system came, they just seamlessly went in and became what? Chiefs of security for banks and so on and so forth, right?
Well, all kinds of things. Or else they moved into the world sort of directly of business and politics themselves. But the point is, in a way, everyone realized that they needed their own KGB. So that's why in the 1990s was the era of everyone's own personal little KGB.
Are there any lessons for today to be gleaned from that?
Well, I think Putin learned that lesson. Mm-hmm. And I think actually you have much, much less tolerance for that. We do see it on a local level, these little sort of circles. But I think of, local politicians, local businesses, local security, police and other apparatuses. But we're not there yet. I think Moscow is still much, much more jealous of its control. If we start to see that, then I really do think that the regime...
The wolves are at the door.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. It stays unnumbered.
All right, well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and take a look at the other side of a coin and why the founder of Russia's top social network and the rector of one of its most prominent universities have decided to leave the country. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining joining us from London via Skype is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFURL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
5 years ago, I created a website which grew into the largest social network in Russia. And,
lesson you take from Russia, and actually you can learn this lesson and apply it into some European countries.
Sergei Gudiev, a prominent economist and rector of Moscow's New Economics University, has apparently fled Russia after falling out with the Kremlin. Gudiev, who has advised Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and whose university was the venue for U.S. President Barack Obama's 2009 speech in Moscow, was recently questioned in an investigation into Mikhail Khodorkovsky's defunct Yukos oil company. He's also donated to Alexei Navalny's online anti-corruption campaign. Gudiev, who is reportedly in France, joins Pavel Durov, founder of the popular social networking site Kontakte, who fled Russia following pressure from the authorities. Kirill, let's start with you. Are we about to see a fresh wave of immigration when the best and brightest start leaving the country en masse?
There were a lot of analogies in Russian liberal press between this the situation around Gudiev and some other prominent figures who decided to leave Russia or to stay in some other countries and so on. And one particular situation in Soviet, in early Soviet history, so-called a ship of philosophers or steamer of philosophers, when Lenin sent to exile several tens of Russian philosophers, historians, and sociologists in 1922. I'm, you know, strongly against all these analogies. And,
of course you are.
Yes, but the question is, we just, you know, spoke about the functions and roles on various political entrepreneurs and so on, and we must speak, I think, in this case, this particular case, about the role of our intellectuals, a role of, you know, perfect minds of Russia in the post-Soviet period of history. And compared to the role of intellectuals and or Soviet intelligentsia during the Soviet period, because it's very important. There is a great difference between you know, function and the role. Yes, Soviet intelligentsia in the Stalin system or even in Brezhnev system was a function. Yes, just to make several services to Soviet regime, very limited services in science, in, you know, literature and culture and so on, and that's all. And the beginning of the end of Soviet ideology and the Soviet Union itself was that Soviet intelligentsia began to play the role, a very important role in Russian society. And that was the beginning, the old dissident movement and so on, yes, and that was the end of the beginning of the end of Soviet Union and Soviet regime. What did we see in the 1990s? We saw that part of post-Soviet intellectuals, especially from the fields, such fields as you know, economy studies or sociology or history or even philology and so on, they wholeheartedly decided to become a functions for their post-Soviet, various post-Soviet political groups and clans and so on. In the end of 1990s, we see the rise of so-called political technologists and so-called black sociologists who served for several political clans as a function to win, you know, the elections, to local elections, or even the election 1996 and 1999 and so on. So they decided to strip their own, role from the essence, the very essence of the fashion, their own, social role to be intellectuals and even public intellectuals. And now what we see in the case of Guriev and some other persons, post-Soviet or Russian intellectuals of the younger generation, they try to return to this initial role, to be public intellectuals in absolutely another environment, in the environment of late Putin regime. And of course, they're failing this battle or the struggle, because now it's a very harsh environment for all these attempts. And I think that in some sense, here we can see the several, comparisons with the Soviet times.
So do we expect a wave of emigration?
Not a wave, because they're not this group of intellectuals, it's not very numerous. Of course, some of them, they prefer to stay and to serve, in any way to survive somehow, financially or, in some other sense. But some of them, of course, definitely they will leave Russia.
Mark, what do you think?
I think I make 2 points. I mean, on the one hand, it's easy to say, well, what is the big deal? Very few countries would not be benefited by a ship of economists leaving their shores. This is just part of the global economy, the mobility thereof. I mean, again, think of this podcast. A Brit who lives in New York and works in New York and is currently living in Prague, an American who lives and works in Prague, and a Russian who's in London. I mean, that is just the nature of the modern world. And that's one way of.
But none of us are fleeing.
we may not be fleeing, but the point is we all make cost benefit analyses about what is more appealing elsewhere. But I think and I think this is the sort of the second point that does mean that it is a big deal. It's that if Russia does become an increasingly negative place for those people who can think, those people who can create, those people who are willing to do anything other than just simply follow the rules, it becomes, that has an impact on its politics. It has a particular impact on its economics. And I think it also reflects something about the whole topsy-turvy world of Russia. I mean, again, it's almost Alice through the Looking Glass, that Guriev himself said that he fled not because Putin and Medvedev had threatened him when he'd spoken to them, but because they had simply said that they were not willing to interfere with the investigations committee's work. Now, in a Western country, that's exactly what we would hope that the president and the prime minister would say.
Right.
In the Russian context, we know full well that that is actually a very alarming thing to hear.
Right.
When everything is politicized. It's just simply saying, well, I could leash the attack dog, but I think it's inappropriate to do so.
Right.
I'll just lock you in a room with him. So, I mean, I think this is for me the concern, not because I think there's going to be any massive migration of Russians out, but that, first of all, that you will have those people who can, who by definition are going to be the richer, smarter ones who can find safe havens elsewhere, will leave. But perhaps equally important, and this is one of the things even that I just discovered, through my work with Russian students, is from there being a relatively low willingness or desire to go back to Russia. Then there were years in which actually people did see that they wanted to get a Western education, to learn Western ways, but then they wanted to take that back to Russia to apply it. I think in the past couple of years, certainly in the past year, just from, and it's terribly anecdotal, but I found that more and more Russian students actually would rather not, or would at least want to spend 5 years in the West just to see how things
right.
go. So, I mean, I think, again, although this is not the sort of a hinge on which great history will pivot, nonetheless, it is part of a worrying sign of Russia, in the name of political security and stability, abandoning a lot of its potential cultural, political, and economic dynamism.
Right. Well, looking at the Guriev case and the Durov case together, I mean, these are kind of two different animals here. I mean, Guriev was a member of the elite. He was the rector of the New Economics University. He advised Medvedev on economics. He's one of the more prominent economists in the country. He seemed to drift to one side of the split in the elite now, and it started to get him in trouble, right? Durov's a different character. He's a he's a maverick, right? I mean, this is the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. I mean, he founded Kontakte.ru, turned it into the most widely used social network site in Russia. It was used extensively by the opposition to organize protests. He bragged about that he didn't shut it down to the opposition after being asked to by the FSB. And there seemed to be no repercussions initially. This is going back over a year ago. But then suddenly he was allegedly implicated in this automobile accident that struck a traffic policeman when he claims he doesn't even own a car. His shares in his company were snapped up by a Kremlin-friendly entity. And then he apparently disappears from the country. So you have an entrepreneur here, a real entrepreneur, not just a political entrepreneur, and a prominent economist calculating it's time to get out. Is this what the Kremlin wants? Do they want? I mean, because there's a part of them think maybe it's just best to have these troublesome people out of here and have somebody who's going to do our bidding running the biggest social networking site in the country. Durov was fine for him to do that when social networking was just kind of this curiosity in the eyes of the authorities. But now that they see it's a serious platform where you can do some serious organizing and get your message out. It's the successor to television, so to speak. Well, the authorities don't want the best and the brightest running that. They want somebody who's going to do their bidding, no? Kirill, I guess we'll go to you.
I think all the situation around Guriev and Durov, it's very symbolic. First of all, about Guriev. Of course, his gesture, you know, just a statement that he, you know, is leaving Russia and will stay in France, has several aims. First, of course, is outside Russia. Yes, it's to show that something is wrong. Something is wrong inside Russia, inside, you know, even the relatively liberal environment of Russian high schools and so on. Second aim is, of course, Putin and especially Medvedev. He is trying to press them to do something with Bastrykin. I absolutely agree that he is trying to, not hinting, just showing them that they must interfere and to do something with Bastrykin and so on. And the third aim is, almost everyone, especially in Russian intelligentsia or intellectuals and so on, either is Moscow or in, you know, any, you know, big or small regional town and city, is obsessed with history. And of course, when such figures as Sergei Guriev or some other people, you know, emigrating from Russia, everyone begins to think about Alexander Herzen, who was, you know, a great, bright intellectual, who was, you know, one of the leaders of Russian immigration revolutionary movement in 19th century, or even about all these, you know, social revolutionaries and social democrats of the beginning of 20th century, or even about the first, second, and especially third wave of immigration from Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So emigration is a very painful word for Russian intellectuals and Russian intelligentsia. And my second point is, I'm very happy that you compare those two figures, Guriev and Durov. Of course, they are very different.
Very different.
And in some sense, this difference is very symbolic. Don't forget that Vkontakte, it's not a proper audience for Russian opposition leaders now. Their platform is Facebook. Mm-hmm. Those who are pro-Western and so on, they prefer to use Facebook.
But they use Kontakte to organize in the provinces.
Of course, yes.
Kontakte is more widely used in the provinces. Facebook's a Moscow-Petersburg phenomenon.
Yes.
Kontakte is out in the regions.
Yes, and that was, I think, one of the most important mistakes of Russian opposition 2 or 1 year ago. They had to extend their influence on the audience or users of Kontakte, mm-hmm. Users of this platform. This is a social field which will decide in some future the fate of Russia. In this sense, all these troubles with Pavel Durov are very symbolic. I am not sure that they are very serious, but they are very symbolic. But in Russia, all these symbolic things are very serious.
Mark, anything to add?
Yeah, I think I very much would agree with Kirill's view. And just to sort of pick up on that last point about the symbolism, on the one hand, yes, you could say that the concentration on Facebook symbolically says a lot about the opposition and being out of tune with Russians. But more generally speaking, I do feel this is terribly symbolic about the current mindset within the Kremlin and within the elite, which is back to it is better to be loyal than to be good. Mm. And that precisely that they don't like the Durovs and the Guriyevs leaving because it just looks bad. But on the other hand, if that's the price to be paid to get rid of these damn individuals who otherwise can be inconvenient, I think it's one that they're willing to live with.
Mm. And so this is just one other, and from the point of view of Guriyev and Durov, this is just another form of entrepreneurship of getting out and playing the costs and benefits. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London via Skype has been co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian Service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. Mark will not be with us. I think we should offer his congratulations. Mark will be getting married next week. After those congratulations, as always, I will leave you as with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC, who will not be playing Mark's wedding.